creation versus evolution. And I know that's a tremendous subject, and what I want to do is just a little overview, outline, specifically as relates to dinosaurs. You know, evolutionists will tell you that dinosaurs went extinct 50 to 70 million years ago. Of course, that doesn't fit the creation story at all. And throw in all those big numbers, and, you know, you kind of feel helpless, like, what could happen in all that time? But when you look closely, there's big cracks in the facade of evolution in their timeline. It didn't really stand the test of time or the test of close scrutiny. And just three things that I come up with to discuss here was that shows a big problem with it. And one of those things happened in 1961. In northwest Alaska, a petroleum geologist, just, I guess he was searching for oil, he found a large bed of bones, large unfossilized bones. They were exposed, I guess, from the ground. And he didn't know what to think of them. He thought, well, they're big bones. They must be bison, buffalo bones, because they weren't fossilized and they weren't, you know, completely destroyed, or they were still mostly intact. But 20 years later, when some scientists got to looking at these bones a little closer, they said, well, gee, they're not buffalo bones, they're dinosaur bones. In fact, they went on to specify they're duckbill dinosaurs. You know, the dinosaur has a funny bill on it. And, of course, that brings into question, how can they be 50 to 70 million years old and still intact, more or less, and not fossilized? It's evidence that they weren't really millions of years old, but perhaps maybe thousands of years. And this discovery actually appeared in the Edmonton Journal, for one place, in October the 26th, 1987, and in Time Magazine, our Tropical Arctic article, in September the 22nd of 86. But, you know, it didn't create much stir, and people just more or less forgot it, and it didn't fit the evolutionary timeline, so it was more or less forgot about. And then later, a T-Rex skeleton was unearthed in Montana, out in the wilds of Montana, pretty inaccessible, in 1990. And it was a pretty much intact skeleton, and of course they wanted to bring it out to the lab and study it. But they had to bring it out in a helicopter, and one of the leg bones were so large they couldn't really load it, so they just sawed them in two, just sawed the leg in two so they could get it in the helicopter. And when they sawed the leg in two, deep inside they found, gee, it's not all fossilized. The bone marrow was, and some of the cartilage, when they added moisture to it, was still squishy and springy, and, you know. And in fact, they dubbed it the Squishosaurus because of that fact. Thank you. And even when they took it to the laboratory and looked at it closer, they could even see the blood veins and red blood cells in this tissue. It was unfossilized. And there again, it brings into question, how could that be 50 to 70 million years old? And then you have my favorite thing that folks hold in that theory is a fish, a coelacanth. And probably some of us have heard of the coelacanth fish. It was supposedly contemporary with dinosaurs and supposedly extinct for 65 million years. And then in 1938, fishermen off the coast of Africa, somewhere I think around Madagascar, they caught a coelacanth fish, of all things. And I can even remember, I guess it was in the 60s or 70s, probably late 60s, maybe early 70s, that on the news they actually caught one of these fish down in the Gulf off of the Yucatan, off of Mexico. Caught another one of these prehistoric fishes, so to claim. And then further study come out that, well, fishermen off the coast of India and I think maybe that Indonesia had been catching and eating these fish for generations. So, you know, they quietly had to change that, you know. And there's even a a society for the preservation of the coelacanth now. So, anyway, that it pokes some holes in the you know, the evolutionary theory. But what does the Bible say? What does it say about dinosaurs? Were they created by God in creation, or what? You know, I think we all know that we can't find dinosaur in the Bible if we look till you went blind, but it's a modern English word for large animal. But if we go to Job chapter 40 and verse 15, we can read some interesting stuff. We'll just turn to Job 40, 15. And, of course, here's God speaking to Job. He's more or less dressing Job down a little bit for being a little bit arrogant. He said, I created both you and, it says here, and I'm reading the Modern English Version. And it says, this is chapter 40, verse 15. And he's speaking to Job. He says, I created both you and, here it says hippopotamus. But down here in parentheses, it says the Hebrew text was behemoth. So, here is God saying He created them both at creation. He said, it eats grass like an ox, but look at the mighty muscles. In its body and legs, it's in its body. And the legs and its tail is like a cedar tree. Well, you know, hippopotamus don't have much of a tail, but when you're talking a tail like a cedar tree, they're not talking about these little cedars that we see around. They're talking about big trees like the cedars of Lebanon. And its thighs are thick, and its bones, and the bones in its legs are like bronze or iron. And when we read this account, it makes me think of Brontosaurus. You know, I've seen scientists' accounts of find these fossilized big animals, and that, you know, by their teeth they can tell that they were plant eaters. And that's what it said about this one. He eats plants. And go on reading, it says, I made it more powerful than any other creature, yet I am stronger still. And undisturbed, it eats grass while the other animals play nearby. It rests in the shade of trees and on river banks. It remains calm and unafraid with the Jordan River rushing and splashing in its face. In other words, it was so large it wasn't an aggressive animal, but it wasn't afraid of other animals. It just really didn't have any enemies. And if we read a little further, I think we'll read an account of a different type of a dinosaur. It's Job 41, verse 1. And here he's talking about, can you catch a sea monster by using a fish hook? Can you tie its mouth shut with a rope? Can it be led around by wringing its nose? And skip down to verse 12. I think we'll get more into it. It says, what powerful legs and what a stout body this monster possesses. Who could strip off its armor or bring it under control with a harness? Who would try to pry open its jaws full of fearsome teeth? Now, this one probably may not have been a plant eater. Its back is covered with shield after shield, firmly bound and closer together than breath to breath. And when you think about this particular animal, again, it brings to mind, you know, I've seen many depictions of different dinosaurs. It sounds like a triceratops, which was armored down its back. Even its head was armored, had a bony shield around its neck, and it had three horns on its head. And, of course, maybe we should stop right there, but it goes on. It speaks of another monster or another large animal. And it's verse 18. 41 verse 18. When this monster sneezes, lightning flashes and its eyes glow like the dawn. Sparks and fiery flames explode from its mouth, and smoke spews from its nose like steam from a boiling pot, while its blazing breath scorches everything in sight. Like I said, maybe we should have stopped at the other two, because many people read this and they're going to say, "Oh well, wait a minute now. That must be parable. That must be something. You know, that doesn't sound like a real. You know, that's a little too fantastic." But you know, I'm not ready to say that myself, because when you look at contemporary animals and insects and things, we can see some really bizarre things. And just one that I made note of is, it's called the bombardier beetle. And I've seen it on science things before. And it's, when it's threatened, it can spray boiling hot toxic chemicals from little ducts in it, the rear end of the thing. Boiling hot, you know, you're talking over 200 degrees. And maybe more amazing than that, the Malaysian ant. When it's threatened, it constricts internal muscles, ruptures sacks of chemicals, and actually explodes. It will explode. It kills itself, but it, I guess, blows up whatever is bothering it. So some pretty amazing things that that God creates. To think that He could create a fire-breathing dragon, to me, is not beyond His ability. And one more thing, deep underneath the ocean, you've probably seen some of these depictions when they go deep underneath the ocean in these deep diving vessels they have, they can actually photograph on the ocean floor what they call hot vents, where you have superheated gas spewing up into the ocean. And it heats the water probably 400 or 500, maybe more degrees. The water doesn't boil because it's pressurized so much. But the amazing thing about it, the amazing thing is they find living organisms in and close to this superheated water. Most of them are like bacteria, amoebas, like one-celled animals. But there's also tube worms. They'll have these big tubes, maybe 8 or 10 feet tall, maybe 6 inches or so, and inside these red worms. And they come out and feed on these bacteria and other little creatures in this super hot water. They probably don't get in the very hottest part of it, but still yet, you know, they're amazed. How can they do that without being killed, you know? So God's creation can be very amazing, and, you know, I don't think it's beyond Him to have a fire-breathing dragon, and read the account of it there. But then you might well ask, say, well, okay, if God created these things, where are they? And of course, I can't give a concrete answer on that, but I think we still see a few relative. Well, like take the coelacanth fish. I mean, it's still around. Komodo dragon, we've probably all seen those. They're pretty ancient-looking deals. I think a Komodo dragon is about 8 or 10 feet long. They're pretty vicious. They can do you in if you're not careful. And most of us have seen snapping turtles. Now, they look pretty ancient to me. They got the old bony ridge down their back and on their head, and they're pretty aggressive. And so I think we can see some evidence. And, of course, you've got fossil evidence of the very large dinosaurs. The question is, the evolutionists say, well, it was millions, 50 million years ago. I think that doesn't hold up under scrutiny when you look at it, that timeline. And it's just very interesting when you closely look at the evolutionary theories, you find that they have trouble standing the scrutiny of time, you know, and close examination. And of course, creation, it's written in the Bible. It either stands the test of time or it fails, and I think we'd agree that it stands the test of time very well.
The title of this message is Circumcise Your Heart. Circumcise Your Heart. What is the greatest work in our universe? What is the greatest work in our universe? I'm going to take a stab at trying to answer that question. But before I do, I ran across a scripture that surprised me a number of years ago, and then I read it again this week, and it's Jeremiah 4:3. And I think you'll see why it surprised me. And I think it would surprise a lot of people because of the perception people have of the New Testament and the Old Testament. Jeremiah 4, verse 3. Jeremiah 4:3 reads, "For thus says the Lord God to the men of Judah and Jerusalem, break up your fallow ground." In other words, when you're plowing hard ground, you have to break it up with a plow. "Break up your fallow ground and sow not among thorns." Here's the key part, verse 4. "Circumcise yourselves to the Lord. Remove the foreskin of your hearts, O men of Judah and inhabitants of Jerusalem, lest my wrath go forth like fire and burn none to quench it because of the evil of your deeds." And God is saying, circumcise your heart because you are all in a bad attitude. And when you read that, that sounds just like the New Testament. Sounds exactly like the Apostle Paul. He's saying, you know, you got a hard heart, just like plowing a hard ground. You need to break it up and become soft toward God. Most people, when Paul talks about circumcise, you know, for Gentiles, you need to just circumcise your heart, they think, well, he's contradicting the Old Testament. He's saying something new. But it's not new. It was in the Old Testament all along. Now, the Judaizing party, and I guess you could say the far right wing of Judaism, they didn't see it. And they, of course, many of them came into God's church and caused trouble. They didn't see it. But it was in the Old Testament all along. I'm not going to go into other verses, but it's in Deuteronomy 10:16. It's also in Jeremiah 9 and a couple of other places in the Old Testament. It talks about circumcising your heart. And people think it's a new concept. But what I want to emphasize today is the Old Testament and the New Testament fit together like hand and glove. Actually, if you think about it, it's really the same God. The same God in both. He was the God who led the ancient God of Israel, that led Israel and inspired Moses and met with Moses on Mount Sinai. That God became flesh and became Jesus Christ and taught the apostles, including Paul, the last one. So it makes sense that the two would fit together. But the world doesn't understand it. I want to go to one verse that the world misunderstands, Galatians 5, and I'll explain it in the context of circumcise your heart, not your flesh. At least it will help us understand this verse that is a mystery to the world. Now, let me also say I'm not surprised that the world doesn't get it because God has blinded the world, and you see that in 1 Corinthians 3. He blinded the religious leaders of those days, and Paul said, like a veil over their face. Same is true today. Actually, the big lies we talked about a few weeks ago is growing. The world's going to get even more blinded. Truth is going to be slipping further and further away, so brace yourself. But anyway, let's look at Galatians 5, 1 through 3. Now, with understanding that to circumcise your heart and not just your flesh is not a new concept. It does not contradict the Old Testament. The Old Testament said it first. Anyway, so Paul says, "For freedom Christ has set us free." He means free from the kind of restrictions the Jewish leadership was putting on, were trying to put on Christians and put on a lot of Jewish people. Actually, when Christ came, he called it a yoke of bondage. He said, "My yoke is lighter." Let me just give you a little background, because it will help us understand the context a little bit. At least a major sect of Judaism believed that you had the written law and you had the oral law. The oral law, they said, is something God told Moses, and he handed it down to the high priests and to the rabbis, and they kind of built on it, and they created their own little book of additional rules besides the written law. Now, Christ, of course, came and heavily criticized that and all their rules, clearly. But people who thought like that, you know, the tradition of the elders, they call it the oral law, Christ set people free from all those restrictions. Now, admittedly, we're specifically talking about circumcision and some of the Jewish things go along with it. But it applied to a lot of Sabbath restrictions. They had tons of rules. They had libraries of books on the oral traditions. For freedom, Christ has set us free. Stand firm, therefore, and do not submit again to the yoke of slavery. Because apparently, after Paul left these churches, established them, erudite Jewish religious leaders, in some places he calls them false super apostles. I guess that's how they came across. They came to these Gentiles and said, we know the Bible better than Paul. We know everything. Paul was a little weak on some things. He didn't tell you the full truth. Follow me. And they were pressuring these people. You can understand the self-righteousness. If you want to be a real Christian, you got to get circumcised. And there are certain verses in the Old Testament you could quote. If you left out that one and some others, you know, how the Bible is, I call it tunnel vision. If you only look at certain verses and don't put it in the context of other verses, and you twist that verse, you can give an unbalanced message. So I could see how they could say, well, look, Moses had to circumcise his family. What do you all think you are? I mean, you could understand. You could easily see how they could do that, right? It makes good sense. They were under pressure. And Paul says, look, I, Paul, say to you that if you accept circumcision, Christ will be of no advantage to you. I testify to every man who accepts circumcision that he's obligated to keep the whole law. Now, you're going to say, does that mean the law is bad? Actually, it doesn't. Here's what Paul is saying. If you take their perspective, which is you're saving yourself because of obeying everything, including circumcision and all the other little rules you're going to come up with, then you have to be perfect in keeping the law. Let me give you the bank robbing example. Let's say there's a bank up in Marion, Illinois, the Bank of Marion. I assume it exists, the Bank of Illinois. And there it is, right on the main street. Every time you drive by that bank and you don't rob it, you're obeying the law, right? And you could drive by there 10 times a day, 100 days. That's 1,000 times of obeying the rule. But if one day you took your little pistol in there and you robbed the bank and got away, you are, and they catch you, and they do catch most bank robbers. There are all kinds of ways they catch people. And they catch you. There's an indictment against you, a legal indictment. And the fact that you kept the law 1,000 times, you drove by that bank and you never robbed it. You kept the law, does not let you off. In other words, if you don't keep the law perfectly, you cannot save yourself by the law. Now, I know we've said this many times, but it's amazing how people don't understand it. Law and grace work together. If there's no law against robbing the bank, then you wouldn't need pardon for robbing the bank, right? So, but if you have no grace, you have no chance. Nobody can keep God's law perfectly. You got to keep the whole law, every bit, your whole life. We're not only saying nobody can do that, we don't even come close to being able to do that. But we all agree? Not even close. Everybody has, a lie has come out of your mouth. Sometimes before you even think about it, I didn't exactly tell them the truth, did I? Or you hit your thumb and you use a letter word you shouldn't use. Well, I won't go into all the possible ways we have sinned all our whole life. There's no way. So everybody has to have grace, and maybe more grace than we even think we need. And it's not so much that circumcision is bad, but I think all of us understand what the Judaizing party wanted to do was they wanted to limit the number of Gentiles in the church, and at least you got to be first become a Jew the whole thing before you get in. And they knew that a lot of 45-year-old men, and they didn't have anesthesia and painkillers like we have today, you go through that operation and you're going to suffer. Well, how many people do you think would join the church if they had to go through that? It was a barrier, and it's clear that that's not what God wanted. Clearly not what God wanted. But people misunderstand that when Paul says you're obligated to keep the whole law. He's not saying the law is bad. He's just saying if you can't keep everything perfectly, you cannot save yourself through that approach. Verse 4. You severed from Christ. Who would be justified by the law. You've fallen away from grace. Now notice, justified. We're not talking about the law done. We're talking about justification. And here's what a lot of churches do. They they think of nullification instead of justification. In other words, the grace of Christ, Christ's blood, has justified us. It's like it covered over your indictment for robbing the Bank of Marion. In other words, you're not guilty. But it doesn't nullify the law. You still shouldn't go out and rob banks all the time. It does not nullify the law. Justification and nullification are two separate things. The law is not done away, and Paul is not saying that. But the Judaizing party is trying to pull people away from the grace of Christ, from appreciating Christ and his grace. And really, the Jews were sort of saying in their own way, you really don't need Christ and his blood. We can save ourselves by keeping the law. Isn't that really what they're saying? We don't need Christ. Believe me, we need Christ. We need his blood. We need his grace. Boy, we need it even more than we think we need it. And they were moving in the opposite direction. And that's what Paul is saying. We need to appreciate the blood of Christ. I want to tell you a story of a man. There was this big wedding. The king was going to have a wedding for his son. It was a big wedding. It was a big sign. He wanted a big crowd into the wedding, but he said nobody can come to the wedding unless they have the appropriate, really nice clothes. So this poor guy lived in rags. He really wanted to go to this big public event, the big wedding, but his clothes are raggedy. So he asked the guard, can I have a private audience with the king? And the guard said, okay. He got a few minutes. He told the king, I'd really like to go. The king says, I'll tell you what. We have plenty of extra royal clothing that we don't need. Go see my son. He's got some stuff he's about to throw away. He's outgrown. Ask for that. So he got some of his son's nice clothing. He gave it to the guy. And he put it on. It looked great. The king said, and this clothes will never wear out. You can use it all your life. So he went to the banquet. But he was so used to his rags that he put them in a bag. Ball his filthy rags. Put them in a bag. And he put it in his lap at the dinner. And then he put it on a stick, and he carried the bag of old rags all around, everywhere with him, even though he had the nice clothes. He doubted whether they'd really last, but they did last. But all his life, he didn't trust the clothes. He kept this ball of rags. And as time went on, people didn't see him as the guy in the nice clothes. They saw him as a bag man with this bag full of old clothes on his back. Now, maybe that's an interesting story, but the message is, trust the grace of Christ. He gives us the new clothes. We don't have to stay with the old man or even trying to do it without Christ. Because in a sense, that's what going back to Judaism would do. In case any of you doubt that Paul was not against God's law, let's go to Galatians 3:21. This is the same letter, just a couple paragraphs sooner. Because Paul knows that what he's saying could mislead people. 3:21, is the law then contrary to the promises of God? Certainly not, or God forbid. Of course not. For if the law had been given that could give life, then righteousness would indeed be by the law. And of course, Christ, being the God of the Old Testament, he's the one that gave the law to Moses on Mount Sinai anyway. Let me just say this. There's nothing wrong with God's laws. Now, maybe some don't apply because we're not a theocracy and we don't have a temple and we don't have Levitical priesthood. Some were for that time period. But the principles behind the laws were all good. It may take some understanding to apply some of them. Let's go to Romans 6:1. Most of us know it, but just for the sake of those who may hear this DVD and don't hear the others, I want to get this on there. Romans 6:1. Because in case someone says, well, Paul in Galatians preached against the law. No, he didn't. Romans 6:1. Now, here he actually poses the question, in case anybody misunderstands him, because he's obviously pushing we need grace, because that's what the Judaizing party was deceiving the Gentiles about in the city of Rome and other places. What shall we say then? Are we to continue in sin that grace may abound? Hey, let's continue being sinners so we can have more and more grace because grace is the thing. Of course, that's dumb. That's like saying, let's sin all the more so God give us more grace and God will be happy. That'd be dumb, of course. Paul says, by no means, or certainly not, or are you crazy? You kidding me? God forbid. What should we say then? Are we to continue in sin that grace may abound? By no means. How can we who die to sin still be living in it? And when we died in the watery grave of baptism and came up, well, we're now new people. We should get rid of our old rags of worldly ways of thinking about religion and rely on grace. But remember we said, circumcise your heart. That's what Jeremiah told the people of Jerusalem. We need to give our heart to God and try to appreciate the free gift of Christ more and be more soft and flexible and open to God. Remember I said the greatest work in the world, what was it? I think the greatest work in our universe right now is to get the love of God inside of us. I personally believe there's no magic. In other words, God isn't going to say, I cast a magic spell, you know, like the genie, and all of a sudden the love of God's in your heart, and you'll love just like Jesus Christ in an instant. It would be nice if it were that way. Wave a magic wand, you'd go from being a self-centered, petty, negative, greedy, foul-mouthed, and whatever negative things we can throw in there, thieving bum. Everybody's a little different, but you get a general idea. Everybody's got some faults. To being a spiritual giant just like that. I remember when I got baptized, the minister said, well, God has probably just squeezed a little teeny bit of your carnality out and got a little bit of his Holy Spirit in there. That's probably a good way to look at it. It is not an instantaneous thing. We have to help God. God's not going to force you to get the love of God in your heart. We have to help him. We have to do our part. Cooperate. And I think coming to church is part of it. Because if, you know, I was talking to a minister today, and I won't go into the details, but he was opining. His church is doing okay, but there's still some people who, over the years, they say, well, I'll just stay home. It's easier, and I'll just listen to tapes or watch something online. And I'm not against, you know, reading literature and watching something online that's good for your tapes, but there's no excuse for fellowshipping with the brethren, learning together, and being there to help and pray for other people. And we both agreed it's self-centered to say, I'll just stay home and grow spiritually. He says, in most cases, when they tried that, within a few years, they were gone. They stopped keeping the Sabbath. It sounds good when you say it, and it's easier. Let me stay home and do my own thing. But it's self-centered, and it doesn't work. Anyway, there's a lot that we have to do to grow spiritually. But let's go to Romans 12, the same book. This is a powerful scripture. There are some others like it, but this is a very powerful scripture. Romans 12, verse 1. The Apostle Paul writes to the Romans, I appeal to you, therefore, brothers, by the mercies of God, to present your bodies a living sacrifice. That means you give it all to God while you're alive. Not when you're dead. Living sacrifice. You're going to give everything to God. Holy and acceptable to God, which is your spiritual worship. And then he says, another part of that, verse 2, do not be conformed to this world, but be transformed by the renewal of your mind, that by testing you may discern what is the will of God, what is the good and acceptable and perfect will of God. The easiest thing to do would be do what the world is doing, right? You know, I want to do Halloween, by the way, is number two holiday. People, adults love to go to parties dressed up as Frankenstein and eat all the candy. And I imagine it's a lot of fun, and I guess Easter eggs and whatever the world does and worldly things. But God says we need to leave the world, become repentant, and give ourselves totally to God. And you know that's not going to be easy. It's like if you got a bundle of old rags, that's the old you, or the worldly way of thinking, don't contaminate the new clothes of Jesus Christ by keeping it with you all the time. I don't feel comfortable unless I'm my old self-centered self. Throw it away. Get away from it as much as you can. Work on it. Don't hold on to the old rags, the old self. Let's go to Romans, back again to Romans 2:28. Romans 2:28. And let's pick it up in verse 27, just to get a little background. Well, we might as well go all the way up to verse 25. Let's get a little more context here. 2:25. For circumcision indeed is of value if you obey the law, but if you break the law, your circumcision becomes uncircumcision. He's actually writing to the Jewish people there. Oh, you know, you're circumcised, and that, you know, is a good thing, and there are some health advantages to being circumcised. But he says, hey, if you're a sinner, the fact that you're physically circumcised won't mean a thing to God because you're not spiritually circumcised. It's the heart that counts. So if a man who is uncircumcised keeps the precepts of the law, will not his uncircumcision be regarded as circumcision? Remember what we read in Jeremiah. That does not contradict the Old Testament. That complements. That's what the Old Testament said. God, through Jeremiah, told the people of Jerusalem, circumcise your heart. So Paul was not contradicting it. He was going along with the real deep meaning and spirit of it. Then he who is physically uncircumcised but keeps the law will condemn you who have the written code and circumcision but break the law. For no one is a Jew. I mean, we're talking about being a spiritual Jew. We like to think we're spiritual Jews or spiritual Israelites. No one is a Jew or a spiritual Israelite who is merely one outwardly, nor is circumcision outward and physical. But a true Jew or a spiritual Israelite is one inwardly. Remember, circumcise our heart. Get it inside of us. Circumcise our heart. Get it inside of us. And circumcision is a matter of the heart, by the Spirit, not by the letter. Because the letter, well, God says we only have to do this. And you can sometimes do the letter, but miss the whole spirit of the law. His praise is not from man, but from God. Sometimes lawyers get people off on technicalities. Call a letter of the law, but not the real spirit. So getting God's love in our heart takes both of us, God and us. It's no magic. We have to do our part. Now, I heard on the internet this guy gave an example of his gardening glove. He has this big glove for trimming his roses. And he says, you know, that glove without my hand in there won't do a thing. I got to get my hand in there to cooperate. And he says, whenever I give it to my kids, they never can get all five fingers and all the right sleeves of the glove. So they never can get it right. It takes a little effort. Well, we're sort of like a spiritual child. We got to learn to use the tools that God has given us. Get our hand into the glove that's God's Holy Spirit and the grace of God and use it to grow. Do our part. Get God's Spirit in us and allow it to help us grow. Let's go to Colossians 2. Still the same topic, circumcise your heart. Colossians 2. And this is one of the churches that I think all of Paul's churches, best I can get out of it, the Judaizing party was after all of them to some extent. Colossians 2, verse 11. Paul writes to them, Colossians 2, 11. Let's see. In him also you were circumcised with the circumcision made without hands. So this is the real circumcision of our heart, not just the physical. By putting off the body of the flesh, by the circumcision of Christ, having been buried with him in baptism, in which you were also raised with him through faith in the powerful working of God, you know, through his Spirit, who raised him from the dead. And you were dead in your trespasses and the uncircumcision of your flesh, he's speaking to Gentiles primarily, God made alive together with him, having forgiven us of all our trespasses. And, you know, he canceled the record of our debt. So the circumcision is really not the important thing. It's circumcising our heart. And that's in accordance with the Old Testament. Paul is not creating some new thing, as the world likes to believe. So we need to do things like go to church on a regular basis, pray for other people, not just yourselves, try to be more loving, and admittedly we're all struggling. And most of all, remember that the Old Testament and the New Testament fit together like hand and glove. There's no contradiction. A lot of people will knock the Sabbath because they say, well, that's Old Testament. That was done away in the New Testament. It's not really true, but, I mean, that's what they will say because they don't see the overall picture. There is no contradiction there. The Sabbath was not done away. The few verses they pick are weak. The truth is, a gigantic church organization before they became the official church of the Roman Empire changed it. And they said they had the power through their church councils and leadership to change it. And most Protestant churches inherited that, but don't admit it or don't know it, the truth be told. But all God's laws are good if applied properly. If applied properly, if not, apply them. And law and grace work together like hand and glove. You don't need grace if there is no law, if there's nothing wrong with it. But nobody can keep everything perfectly. Human nature is just not possible, even at a certain point in your life. Well, I'm now ready to truly not disobey God. You're still going to make a lot of mistakes. We need grace, and we probably need a whole lot more grace than we even realize. And we have to rely on Christ, not on ourselves. Let's say if you're a person of great willpower, and you're kind of worshiping your willpower. I'm going to will myself, and I'm going to have an iron discipline regimen. I'm going to fast 2 days a week. I'm going to tithe on every leaf in my garden, and I'm going to be... Does that sound familiar? Does that sound like the Pharisees? You see what Christ said about them. I'm not against willpower, but we have to be repentant and rely on Christ. You're not going to do it on your own. I want to talk for a minute about Acts 15 without reading the whole thing. I'm just going to paraphrase it. But a lot of people who were Pharisees in the past, they came into God's church, but they still considered themselves Pharisees, which shows you they had to be keeping God's law, or there's no way they could have done that. And they were spreading information throughout the burgeoning churches in the empire that Paul was wrong. All these thousands of Gentiles coming to God's church have to be forced to be circumcised. So it's a big conference. So the church had, they call it the Jerusalem Conference, Acts 15. All the leading elders and apostles and all the right people were there. And both sides, it probably was maybe even several days of arguing. Both sides had plenty of time to present their arguments. But in the end, Peter and Paul told the story of how God's Spirit, well, Peter talked about, and you can read it in Acts 10, how Cornelius and others with him, totally uncircumcised Gentiles, Italians, were given God's Holy Spirit without being circumcised. And Peter said, who was I to resist God? Like, it wasn't Peter's idea. Peter said, wait a minute, I wouldn't have done it, but God did it. And of course, Paul then talked about all the miracles he did and all the large numbers of people he converted. And there's no way a reasonable church could say that's not God's will. And basically all the church did at that point was say, look, a Gentile just has to agree to give up some of the most egregious stuff that we Jewish people don't like about Gentiles, you know, drinking blood and a few other things like that. And the rest they'll learn because the law of God, you know, they said Moses, but that means basically the Old Testament laws, will be read to them every Sabbath. And they'll learn all the other stuff. And you would think the issue would have been decided, wouldn't you? And I guess it's the devil, or is it human nature? Some people, they don't give up. Of course, Paul says some of them were false brethren who just wanted to keep the truth away from the Gentiles in any great number. But whatever their motivations were, a party grew up secretly, and they would follow Paul. Paul would come, he'd raise a Gentile church, they'd be doing great. Probably a year or two after Paul left, he'd start hearing a bunch of these super apostles from the Judaism world have gotten in there, and they're undermining the people. And so Paul had to write basically the majority of the New Testament. And in most, even in Galatians, he says, I hope they cut it off. I mean, it's there if you read a good translation. That's how angry Paul was at the Judaizing party. And I imagine they made the Gentiles who went for that even 10 times more self-righteous than they were. But here's the problem. When we read some of those things in Galatians and other books, if you don't have the balance, you think it means that you don't have to obey God at all. You can live any way you want to as long as you say, you know, I trust Jesus and his blood to save me. poof, you can just do anything you want. Obviously, that's not true. But you know how the world is. They overlook those scriptures we read today. They only look at certain ones. So we want to be sure we have a balanced look, that what God was saying in the Old Testament, in the New, and the New, is that you need to circumcise your heart. There's nothing wrong with circumcising babies on the eighth day. Obviously, it's physically good for them, and there are plenty of health studies that prove it. But that's really not the important thing. The important thing for us adults is to circumcise our heart. And every Sabbath, we can learn more and more what we should do. But the evil circumcision, probably related to the Pharisees' party, secretly undermined churches. And we see that in our day, too. We've had ministers' conferences decided issues, but it doesn't matter what's taught, what's said. There are people sneaking behind our back, and they undermine church people all the time with false doctrines. Many of them do it for money, to get their own group, for following, for power. But whatever the reasons, or they're just deceived, it's one of those things we have to live with. Got to get used to it. Someone said, what's the best way to keep from being deceived? One of my old teachers, Big Sandy, said, you need to have your truth detector upgraded. He says, for instance, if you take a piece of art, you know, real great piece of art, and an expert can tell a good forgery quickly, but most people can't. There's some false Rembrandts and even false money that looks so good. If you're not a real expert, you can't tell it. He said, well, how do the experts do it? Well, they have studied, you know, the real Rembrandts and all those other art pieces so thoroughly, they can spot even a great forgery. They'll know. Well, our truth detector is the Bible, this book. We need to study it and study it and study it some more and think about what we've studied. And often, when something looks good, but something inside you says, yeah, but, and you start thinking the yeah, but, you'll eventually find something that goes counter to some Bible principle, and you'll realize, well, this is dangerous. But we need to strengthen our truth detector. Anything that says any parts of God's law are bad, or if they say any book in the Bible is bad. They say the book of Ezra. Well, Ezra meant well, but he was wrong. Oops. I deep six that guy's idea. There's nothing in the Bible that's wrong. Now, maybe we don't understand it as well as we could, but nothing that God has done, said, or written is wrong if properly understood. Or if they say, well, the Old Testament was written by an old, feeble God who was out of touch. The New Testament was written by a young, energetic, really hip Jesus Christ. No, 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 no. They're written by the same person. And you'll see that in the first parts of the book of John, that the God of the Old Testament became flesh and became Jesus Christ. All along, God was full of grace. Let's go to Exodus 34, 6 and 7. Because people think, well, you know, grace just started with the New Testament. And that's not true. Exodus 34, 6 and 7. And as the law is being given, here's what, and the Lord passed before him and proclaimed, the Lord, meaning the Lord, that's the God, ancient God of Israel, called Jehovah or other variations of that pronunciation, a God merciful and gracious. Notice the first, when he comes to Mount Sinai, what's the first thing that God tells Moses about himself? That he is merciful and gracious, slow to anger, abundant in steadfast love, faithfulness, and keeping steadfast love for thousands, forgiving iniquity. Now, when you think of Moses on Mount Sinai and the God of the Old Testament, you don't usually think of that, because usually the world doesn't describe him that way. But that's what God said about himself, forgiving iniquities and transgressions of sin. But, of course, there is a tougher side to God, too, which is mentioned after that. I'm not saying God doesn't have a tougher side. But notice the first thing he mentioned was his graciousness and forgiving. By the way, I'm not going to read this, but if you were to go to Jonah, the fourth chapter, basically what Jonah tells God is, When God forgave Nineveh, a rival and potential enemy of Israel, and Jonah wanted them destroyed, Jonah said, "That's exactly what I said. Why do you think," this is Jonah speaking to God in a bad attitude, "why do you think I got on the boat and went the opposite direction from coming to witness these people like you told me? Because I knew that you were a gracious, forgiving God, and I was afraid you might forgive them." And Jonah's a prophet. He knew God. And, of course, he was right. God was gracious, forgiving. He did forgive Jonah. And they did eventually become a powerful force and took the northern 10 tribes to captivity. I understand Jonah's perspective, but God is gracious and forgiving, and Jonah understood that. And we all need to soften our hearts to God. Give God and His laws and His church all our uncircumcised hearts.